This is Instant Replay on Sports Radio 92.7 WFNZ, featuring the best of the best from today's conversations, observations, and ruminations, because great radio is still fresh the second time around. Earlier today on the Mac and Bone Show.
Let's bring on the man, the myth, the legend, America's long snapper, the Panthers' Iron Man. He is number 44 in your program. He is number one in your hearts. He is J.J. Jansen. We got to do some Snapchatting here, ladies and gentlemen. We got rules changes to get the man's thoughts on. J.J., what's going on, brother?
Happy North American baseball opening day. We had Korean baseball opening day a week ago, so hopefully it won't be as an exciting week this week for the North American opening day.
JJ, before we get into the real stuff here, the rule changes and a new teammate for you, how about, I know there's a couple games on MLB Network today, but how about on rollout day in America, as you mentioned, there is one game on national TV, and it's happening during March Madness. ESPN has Cubs-Rangers tonight. There's MLB Network has a few sprinkled in there, but shouldn't there be, like, national games galore in the afternoon today on opening day?
Well, a little bit of the disadvantage was I think a few games got preemptively rained out.
Yeah.
My Braves are up in Philly. They got pushed to tomorrow. I think maybe there was a Yankee game pushed.
The Mets.
The weather didn't cooperate. What is it, the Mets?
Yeah.
That didn't cooperate. But it's always funny for a league that goes 162 games and has very few off days. They always build in like three or four off days in the first week, and I have no idea why. But the Thursday start gets pushed to Friday. They're probably smart to not spend too much time fighting March Madness here early. But the Cubs-Rangers will be a great game. You know, Cubs always pull, and Rangers obviously are the defending champs. So
watch my birdies. Watch my Baltimore birdies, baby.
Just so you know, in the Jansen household, the Orioles are the favorite AL team, because we've got Adley Rutschman, Gunnar Henderson. My son Luke is very much looking forward to the eventual promotion of Jackson Holliday.
Yes.
Corbin Burns, a big free agent pickup. So the Orioles are sort of our AL alternative.
That's just like our household. Our household is yep. Orioles, and then Braves are our NL. That's just like our household. All right, let's
get it. So we can get those. I'm going to go early. I think you guys would call this a futures bet. We'll go Braves, Orioles in the World Series.
Oh, it'd be beautiful. That would be beautiful, yep. Man. The Matt Jansen Invitational, the Fall Classic.
Right.
Oh, it'd be beautiful. All right. You know why you're here, though, JJ. I know you love baseball, and you wish you could do an hour straight on baseball with us.
We're going to drop hips here a little bit.
But we need to hip drop and roll, baby, right now. We need. I think that's a beer from Nota Brewing. We need to get your rules changed thoughts. So let's start with.
I'll drop and roll.
Let's start with the swivel hip drop tackle thing. And again, I always fully disclaim this. I played football for a season. I was scared. I hated it. I was too much of a wuss. I tried to quit in the middle of the season. My dad wouldn't let me. Like, so I full disclosure, you guys are the real men and I'm not. But I really worry about this just making tackling from the side or behind for small DBs like way too difficult. What do you think about this?
Well, I think one of the most interesting little tidbits that came out of the rule change was the Mark Andrews tackle, which a lot of people kind of, this is when I feel like the hip drop thing became a real big, like, national talking point, was after the Mark Andrews injury. And they basically said, this isn't even like what we're really looking for. You know, we're looking for, okay. I think you kind of mentioned like the three parts, like there's a twist, there's a weight drop, and falling on the ankles. Like,
yeah.
I thought that was very interesting. Again, those types of plays at the goal line, I don't know that that's necessarily what they're trying to eliminate, although I'm sure there'll be a little bit of carryover, as there always is. And in the preseason, there'll be flags flying. That's just the way the NFL gets their rule changes across. I think where you're going to see it the most is plays near the sideline, plays involving quarterbacks, that they are going to be very careful that guys aren't just grabbing on and falling intentionally. So I think you're going to see an overemphasis on guys kind of running through the tackle or trying to body up the guy as opposed to just falling on legs. And look, I think there's going to be a few times where, like, how else was that guy supposed to make the tackle? I think that's going to be very real, and we're going to get it. Same way we talk about how are you supposed to hit the quarterback if you can't hit him high and hit him low? But these guys on defense are so athletic that I think they will be able to make some reasonable adjustments. And within about 4 or 5 weeks, usually by the end of the preseason, I think everyone will be fairly comfortable on how to tackle.
How difficult, though, in real time will this be for officials to really gauge if it was a hip drop or not? I know that they can get used to it, but I fear that the referees already have a hard job. They're under scrutiny. Isn't this another one to the docket that is going to be really tough to judge it in real time?
I think it's going to be very tricky at times, but again, like all other things, they're going to eventually be able to get a good sense of what they're looking for. Again, it's kind of three parts, and I think what you're really going to see is, are guys' legs getting landed on, and are players kind of twisting their bodies and contorting their bodies? So I think they're going to be fine. I think the officials will get used to it the same way they've gotten used to every other rule. I do feel bad for defenders. At some point, you just go, how else are you supposed to get a guy down? But in the end, it'll be good for the game because your best players are less likely to get injured, and that's good for everybody.
JJ Jansen with us, a little Snapchats Thursday edition here.
JJ, 21 career tackles, the text line says for JJ.
Yeah, you were questioning his tackles earlier in the week, Bob.
No, I just said I don't know the number that he has, and per the research department of the text line, JJ has, is that accurate, JJ, 21 tackles?
That sounds right. Look, if the text line could find another 100 or 20, 100, 200 tackles in there, that'd be fantastic. But I think what just said about
dig up, come on, yo.
If they could just keep digging and find a few more, that'd be excellent too.
Please, got to be some assists in there, y'all. Come on,
next time
now.
JJ has one, I hope the crowd goes Luke.
Yeah, you should get that Luke treatment. You really should.
Yeah, you could pass off some of Dan Connor's tackles, probably.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Again, I'll do the AJ Klein move, and I'll just point to the back of my jersey. Most of the time, I'm just trying to make sure I'm in one piece when I get up from a tackle.
So. Oh gosh.
JJ, the rule that affects you, the new XFL style kickoff rule. What are your thoughts on this? And the impact this will have on not just you, but the sport in general.
Well, I don't know if it's going to affect me unless all of a sudden I find myself on the kickoff team. But
that's true.
He's both trying to get you more tackles. He wants you to do kickoffs.
That's what I was saying.
I
put you on all special teams plays right now.
That's good. That is good forward thinking. If I want more tackles, I'm going to have to get on more kickoff teams.
There you go.
But I think you're going to see a very big change in the way that play will look. I think you're going to see much bigger people. I think you're going to see offensive linemen and tight ends, defensive linemen. I think it's going to get to be a much bigger play, especially kind of on the front side of a kick. Remember, in the old rule, you had to defend against an onside kick, so you had fast players, typically linebackers, some fullbacks, an occasional wide receiver that would play on the front line because you had to defend an onside kick and then run back to block. Well, now there is no onside kick. So you're going to have much bigger people on that play, and it's going to be a much slower play. And so I would imagine bigger people up front, again, maybe some backup offensive linemen, some tight ends, some D linemen, and then I wouldn't be totally shocked to see more of the Tyreek Hills of the world standing back there. It's a much less violent play, much less dangerous. So I imagine teams are going to be more forward with putting their very, very best athletes back at kick returner.
I mean, the cool thing about this to me, JJ, is it is a safety rule in part, right? Because the collisions will not be as hard. They won't get that running start, the coverage team. And you also, I think, improve the game because now you make the kickoff return a factor again. The XFL was averaging almost 9 kick returns a game. Y'all were in the NFL at like 2.2 last year. That's huge.
Yeah, the NFL adjusted to the injury data and said, let's eliminate the play. They tried to make it safer, but they said the best way to make the play safe is to just not do it.
Yeah.
But then you get the Super Bowl where there's no action. It's like, well, this isn't any fun anymore. And to the NFL's credit, they go, we're not doing ceremonial plays. We're in the business of having action. Obviously, that's what happened with the PAT rule. They're trying to figure all those things out. So it's not a ceremonial play. I think in the XFL, something like 87% of all kickoffs were returned. You had a few miss hits, and I'm sure there was a few strategic, we're just going to kick it out of the end zone, give you the ball at the 30 or 35 or whatever it was, and let's move on. But the ball's going to be in play. So I hate to tell it you guys, but you're not going to be able to run off and grab yourself a hop, drop, and roll and more snacks. That's going to be a real play where the ball's in play. And again, I think teams are going to put their very best returners back there. And it's not a surprise. This rule gets passed. Dan Franklin gets re-signed. Cordarrelle Patterson goes to Pittsburgh. Like, you see teams going, oh, special teams is going to be at a priority. Let's get these guys under contract because this is going to be a big play.
JJ, the best text that we have gotten so far today, maybe the best one JJ's ever gotten is, I am curious, Matt, can you ask JJ if he's ever hanging out at a cookout in someone's backyard and they start to just let him long snap for fun? I imagine someone holding an empty beer can 20 yards away and JJ sees if he can snap it and knock the beer can out of a guy's hands. Has this been a yard game that you've played?
Not a yard game, but great point. We've never gone full varsity blues and try to knock a beer can off the top of the head. But inevitably, at most barbecues, especially with new folks, at some point, someone asks for a demonstration. They try it, then it's pretty ugly. Then they're like, how do you do it? And then I try to explain it, and then you can't explain it, so you just have to do it. And then all of a sudden, I'm snapping a beer can or a soccer ball or a kid's Nerf football. And you know, the pressure's on. When you're snapping a kid's Nerf football and you're not really sure how much it weighs, there's a lot of pressure that you don't send that thing airmailing because you're not quite sure what it is you're snapping here. So look, those are as pressure packed as any fourth quarter field goal snap.
Oh yeah, as
Mrs. Jansen ever said on the way to an outing, look, don't be tempted to just snap things into the air.
No snapping today, JJ.
No, but I will tell you a funny story about my wife Laura. She has this recurring dream. It comes up, let's say, 3 or 4 times a year. That it's a nightmare that she is my backup. And there is a case of, like, I have forgotten to show up at the stadium, and so she is now being put into duty, and she always says, I get on the field, it's like, I don't know how to long snap. Why am I the backup? And I always tell her in the morning when she tells me this story, I said, it's the family business. Everyone's got to be all in. So if I'm out, you're in.
Oh, my God, what a dream.
JJ,
what a
dream.
It's also smart because it makes sure the checks all go to the same bank account.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, you don't want to have to lose that income. That's got to still come to the Jansen.
No, that's good. Yes. We're working together here.
JJ, real quick, what are your thoughts on your new teammate coming home, Jadeveon Clowney, yesterday?
Look, it's like, that's fantastic. You know, I was sort of like many who thought, well, he's obviously not going to sign till May, June, and July because that's just sort of his habit. So I was thrilled that we were able to sign him. Look, he had a fantastic year last year, obviously former number one pick, and it's going to do a world of help for our defense. Obviously, we've talked about a couple weeks ago, we lost some really good players, Burns, Luvu, Chin, and needing to sort of restock that defense, and he was fantastic. A lot's been made statistically of his sacks last year, and I know a lot's been made of his pass rush win rate, which was number 4 in the league. But another little piece that I'll mention is that he was also double-teamed as high as just about anybody other than, like, Myles Garrett and Micah Parsons. Like, he was succeeding while also getting a lot of attention. And you want as many of those guys as possible because now you're going to get more single blocks for some of the other guys on the offense or on the defensive line. And obviously, we're going to have a lot of other young players, probably a draft pick or two. And so you want to make their lives as easy as possible. When you have a guy like Clowney, again, with his pedigree, his success, that is a huge benefit to the whole defense.
All right, JJ. Your wife has an interesting recurring dream. I guarantee you I will dream tonight about JJ Jansen snapping me an IPA in the backyard during a cookout.
I will have that dream.
God, that would be glorious.
We're going to put it right on the right hip. Perfect for you for opening.
There you go, baby.
That'll be a future Super Bowl parade moment when JJ snaps a beer to Mac off one of the floats.
Oh, what a moment that could be. What a moment that could be. All right, JJ, we appreciate you, brother. Great stuff. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. I just love that you guys have somehow figured a way to get on the float already for the Super Bowl.
We're in the crowd. You're snapping
the beer in the crowd.
Yeah.
I'm much more comfortable with you guys in the crowd.
We would
never invite ourselves to the parade float. Are you kidding me?
All right. There you go. That's JJ Jansen.
Listen to Mac and Bone every week. weekday morning from 6 to 10. Instant Replay continues with more in a moment. Only on Sports Radio 92.7 WFNZ.
The exclusive home of the Charlotte sports fan.
You're listening to Instant Replay on Sports Radio 92.7 WFNZ. Because great radio the second time around is always twice as nice. Earlier this week on the Wes and Walker Show.
Now let's head to the Body Works Plus guest hotline and welcome Joe Person, covering the Carolina Panthers well, as he always does. You can follow him on Twitter at Joseph Person and go to The Athletic and read the latest articles. He's covering everything with Dave Canales, Dan Morgan, speaking to the media about all of the things they've done this offseason. Joe, we appreciate the time, man. How are you?
I'm good. How y'all doing?
We're doing well, Joe. We got a lot to catch up on. So let's get started just with what Dave Canales has talked about and really how we've gotten to know him. Like, we got to know Dave Canales when he was introduced as the head coach, a little more at the combine, now more so at coaches' meetings and breakfasts. What kind of impression is he leaving in your mind, Joe, as we get to know him a little bit more, just for you and maybe the rest of the NFL getting to know him?
Yeah, a lot of energy, a lot of optimism, and that was really kind of a hallmark we saw with him, even at his introductory press conference. And I think a lot of that, not that he wasn't wired this way already, but I think working for Pete Carroll for as long as he did, at 13-14 seasons, it just, you know, I think that rubs off on your coaching style. And Pete Carroll, even into like 69, 70 years old, you know, we'd see him, those clips from the Seahawks practice field where he's running around and chewing gum and just looking like a guy who was about 20 years younger than he was or is. And so I think a lot of that is Dave Canales' makeup. And obviously, he's got a lot more. I mean, this is just what I'm talking about, his personality. I mean, from a football perspective, we heard him yesterday. The thing I found most interesting at the owners' meetings that he talked about was his kind of approach to getting to know Bryce Young. I wrote about it for the Athletic. I kind of turned it into a column. But he's not going to just like jump in and say, okay, we got to fix your footwork and we got to get you deeper on drops. Even though both those things might be true, he wants to get to know him on a personal level. And all coaches are like this, but Dave Canales, you kind of stop and listen to, because he's had a pretty terrific track record, especially with quarterbacks and especially, you know, getting quarterbacks to, you know, have their best seasons under his watch.
Well, yeah, what else stuck out to you about that conversation, Joe? You did write about it. What else stuck out to you about Dave Canales and how he views Bryce Young, the quarterback, and what he has to do to improve his game?
So this was twice now that in this offseason in public settings, really is only two public comments, one at the Combine and then this week down in Orlando. And both times he kind of pulled the curtain back a little bit, which I found pretty fascinating. At the Combine, you'll remember, he was talking about just getting the ball out of Bryce's hands quickly. And I mean, he was very specific. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was like, if it's the third read, we want that to happen within like 2.7 seconds. If it's a slant or if it's something quick, 1.7. And it just really fascinating stuff. And the idea being is they don't want Bryce Young sitting and patting the ball and just sitting and sitting and sitting in the pocket, which we saw sometimes last year. And that's not only a knock on Bryce, maybe more so, you know, kind of an indictment of what the former staff was trying to do with them. A lot of traditional kind of, you know, they ran some pistol. But even when they run the pistol, you know, a lot of times it was slower developing plays, which was not a great recipe for, you know, that offensive line, especially when the guards got hurt. But, you know, I would say that from the Combine. And then, like I say, yesterday wasn't so much about X's and O's with Canales. I just thought it was some neat insights into how he approaches the coach-quarterback relationship.
Joe Person joins us on the Body Works Plus guest hotline. You can follow him on X or Twitter at Joseph Person. Joe, what's your opinion on the manner in which the Carolina Panthers have attacked this offseason, and how does it compare to you against other offseasons?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, for whatever it's worth, I did a report card on that very question and a couple, I don't know, 10 days ago or so. And overall, I gave them a B-. The Brian Burns trade kind of weighed them down just because I thought they could have gotten a little more in return from him and for him. And some of that, you know, Dan Morgan was Scott Fitter's second command, as you guys know. And that it's easy to go back now and say they should have pulled the trigger when the Rams offered so much. Well, they should have. And there were some people in the building that, you know, were encouraging Fitter to do so. But Tepper and Fitter and, you know, to a lesser extent, Dan Morgan, you know, they held on to him. But at any rate, so Morgan did the best he could, I think, under the circumstances. It had sort of reached loggerheads with the agent and the Panthers front office, even with this new regime. I just think at that point, Todd France, the agent, and Burns were looking for a fresh start, and so they get it. The rest of the moves, I kind of like them. I kind of like the idea of following or at least kind of patterning the Saints old model of how they protected a shorter quarterback in Drew Brees, and that was spend some money and fortify the interior line, which, as you guys know, was a big problem last year when both those starters went out. And so it's $100 million is a lot of money to spend on a guard, but I thought Robert Hunt was the best pass protector among the free agent guards in this class, and really I don't think it was close. I mean, he is just a beast in terms of keeping people off of Tua when he was in Miami, and hopefully stays healthy and does the same here for Bryce. So I like those moves at guard. You know, you obviously still got to, you know, have Icky get back to his rookie form. And then the defensive moves on the defensive side of the ball, getting guys with ties to Ajero Evero makes a lot of sense. I would have liked to have seen them when they lost Frankie Luba. I would have liked to have seen him sign Patrick Queen. They were in on Patrick Queen, didn't get it done. He goes to Pittsburgh. You know, they got Josie Jewell from Denver, who knows Ajero. That was fine. I don't think he's as good a player as Patrick Queen, but it makes a lot of sense getting guys in their late 20s, kind of their first free agent deal, who know this staff, particularly Avero.
Joe, the Panthers have reportedly arranged a top 30 meeting with Texas running back Jonathan Brooks. Do you think that there's any chance that they spend some draft capital on a running back early or late?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've heard Dave Canales in no uncertain terms say that he is almost stubborn when it comes to sticking with the running game. He did that at Tampa last year when, frankly, they weren't very good at running the football, and he felt like it, you know, it served a purpose, that it kind of loosened defenses up, and, you know, it helped Baker Mayfield, even though they weren't necessarily getting big chunks and gashing defenses with that running game. You know, he is a believer in having a mix there and staying committed to the run game. So he may look at this current roster or the current stable of backs, if you will, and think they could do better and add somebody that maybe is a better fit for what he wants to do. So that wouldn't surprise me. You know, I would be surprised if they drafted one in the second round before they draft a wide receiver. I just think, you know, they've upgraded there a little bit with Deontay Johnson, but there's more work to do there and near or at the top of the second round if they choose to trade down out of 33. And even at 39, I think you get a pretty good day one starter at wide receiver. In among this group, so I'm okay with a running back, but not before a wide receiver.
So to piggyback off of that one, with a potential wide receiver selection, which they've been linked to that with their first pick at 33, is that due to them being a little bit leery of Jonathan Mingo and where he is, or they just want to continue to bolster that wide receiving core?
Yeah, I think a little bit of both. I mean, I do think that there were some concerns, among, a bunch of people in the building that Mingo was just not. He showed up raw last year out of Ole Miss. I would have thought they would have seen that on tape, but they take him pretty high in the second round, and he was just, in terms of route running, he was unpolished. There were some balls. I've had some people point out certain plays from certain games. I think one that we've even talked about before was the Chicago game where Bryce threw a pretty nice deep ball, and if Mingo hadn't kind of gotten a little off track on his route, it's probably a really sizable catch in a fairly close ball game. But I don't think they haven't given up on him yet, not by any stretch, but I do think that is a position where they want to continue to add and continue. I mean, we heard Dan Morgan say it at the combine, that they need playmakers at that position, and I'd be shocked if they don't do something in the draft early on that second day.
Talking Panthers with Joe Person of The Athletic on the Body Works Plus guest hotline. Something else Dan Morgan said, Joe, was that J.C. Horn's fifth-year option has not been picked up yet, so they haven't made a decision on that. Are you surprised that they seem so hesitant on picking up that fifth-year option for a first-round pick that, when on the field, is pretty good?
Yeah, not really. That may have been a case of still, I mean, that decision's another month and a half away, and maybe Morgan just didn't want to put it out there publicly quite yet. But I would think that's the direction this is headed. I mean, it's and I know it is a big caveat, if and when he's healthy, he's a very good corner and physical presence and all that. And you just look around the league, and I think that number's around $12 million for his fifth year pickup. And I mean, not that that's paltry, but if you get a healthy J.C. Horn, even if he plays, say, 14 games instead of 17, I think that is a fairly straightforward decision from where I'm concerned. But yeah, I was, to answer your question, I was a little surprised that he didn't put it out there this week when I asked him about that. But I think that's where this is headed.
Joe, you wrote about Jadeveon Clowney, the sweepstakes surrounding him, Carolina, the Jets also interested in landing the edge rusher. You said it too in your tweet promoting your column. If they can't land Jadeveon Clowney, it's slim pickings out there. How important is it for them to land somebody of Clowney stature? And if they don't, what's plan B?
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, and I almost took that column a different direction. I mean, because we all saw this a similar thing play out last summer, where Frank Reich and Scott Fitter went out and got one of Reich's guys in Justin Houston, who proceeded to just steal $6 million from the organization. First of all, Clowney's 3 years younger than Houston was last year. I think. The track record. I mean, Justin Houston had a track record too. So I just think that Clowney, you really hope that he went and did the thing last year in Baltimore where he wanted to try to win a Super Bowl. He took way less money to do it, and he proved it. If it was a prove it deal, he proved that he could still do it at 31 years old. I think he's going to, from everything I've been told, he wants to get paid this year. And I think the paycheck's probably more important than necessarily going to a place that is ready to win a Super Bowl, which helps you if you're Carolina. You just hope that it's not a case where, the injury bug bites him, at 31, as I said. But I've asked somebody this week, did they think it was, you know, important. And we all make, and especially in the media, where I think we're all guilty of like, oh, come play in your hometown. And sometimes you find out the players don't really care about that. But I asked that question, and I was told, yeah, Clowney actually thinks that would be kind of cool toward the end of his career. So we'll see. But plan B, I don't know. I don't think it's going to – I mentioned a couple guys in that column with ties, in Jerry Hughes' case, ties to Buffalo and when Morgan was there. And then in the case of Randy Gregory, he was in Denver for a year with the Jero. I was pointing out, do not shop hungry for guys like that. And I don't think they will. It's probably some younger guys. I mean, I'm interested in Hassan Reddick, too, because these guys know him. They know the kind of player he is. I mean, I know Fitter, you know, was the guy, and Matt Rhule were running things back then. But Dan Morgan was around. And so I'm not ready to completely shut the door on that yet. But I do think the fact that Hassan Reddick has made it clear he wants to be among the higher paid edge rushers, when this team just went through that with Burns, or this front office did, think that could complicate things if they wanted to go down the Hassan Reddick trade route.
Well, and last thing I'll ask you here, Joe, it's Stephon Gilmore, also a potential come home candidate. You're mentioning Hassan Reddick, both guys former Panthers. Is there any bad blood in the way that the Panthers operated in letting those guys go, not prioritizing them and instead prioritizing other players? Or does money just make everyone forget all about that and they can come together once more?
I think money makes everyone a little happier. honestly, I mean, and Reddick, here we are talking about the hometown thing again. I've read comments from him that he thought it was pretty cool he got to go play in Philly, where he grew up just across the river in Camden, New Jersey. Gilmore left here and made some more money at Indy and in Dallas, and has played well. So, no, I don't think so. I mean, it'd be different if they felt like they were somehow really grossly disrespected, but I don't get the impression that's the case.
That's Joe Person joining us on the Body Works Plus guest hotline. Always great stuff. Make sure you read his column. It's necessary as a Panthers fan, on Twitter at Joseph Person, and make sure you subscribe to The Athletic to make sure you are getting all of your Panthers coverage. Joe, we always appreciate it, man. Thanks again.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
You can hear Wes and Walker live and local every weekday afternoon from noon to 3. Sit tight and stay locked, because Instant Replay continues next, only on Sports Radio 92.7 WFNZ.
The exclusive home of the Charlotte sports fan.
This is Instant Replay on Sports Radio 92.7 WFNZ. Earlier this afternoon on the Kyle Bailey Show.
I said this with our friends Joe Ovius and Joe Giglio earlier today, and they looked at me like I had three heads. I have a feeling this could be a Ben Middlebrook game, because the Clemson transfer is going to be on the court a lot with nobody guarding him. And so if DJ Burns can get him the ball in positions where Ben Middlebrook just has to throw it up into the basket, or, you know, slam it off the glass in the square and it goes in, you know, Ben Middlebrook could have a big game tonight.
The prophecy was foretold 7 days ago on this show. Luke DeCock, mere hours ahead of NC State and Texas Tech in the round of 64. You heard it right there. He said, I think it's going to be the Ben Middlebrooks game, the Clemson transfer. And boy, he was right, man. 21 points for Middlebrooks that night, 54 points combined between the state bigs, him, Burns, and Mo Diarra. It was a hell of a night, and State, of course, would win that one. They'd win again on Saturday, defeating Oakland. And tonight, they face Shaka Smart and the Marquette Golden Eagles. NC State, the lowest-seeded team remaining in the NCAA tournament. And I said tonight, that game is tomorrow. That's like my fourth mistake today. I apologize, Smoke. NC State tomorrow. But in Dallas, live from Dallas right now, the prophet himself, Luke DeCock, Raleigh News and Observer, longtime sports columnist. He's back with us on the Body Works Plus guest hotline. Luke, how does it feel to be a prophet?
Embrace the madness, Kyle. Embrace it.
Oh, I always do. But, I mean, how does it feel to be a sports prophet?
I don't know. I thought that was pretty... I thought that was a pretty reasonable prediction to make. Obviously, others thought I was crazy, but that seemed to me like the way things were going to go, and they did. So, Texas Tech ended up being a terrific matchup for NC State. They really couldn't stop what NC State did well. And the things Texas Tech did well, NC State could fight through. So, we all want to draw these grand, big comparisons about the ACC and the Big 12. I think that was just X's and O's. That was a great matchup for NC State and a terrible matchup for Texas Tech. And NC State did what it had to do to win.
All right. I have texters immediately hitting us up saying, all right, what picks do we need to make tonight then, Luke? Give me the prophecy of the week. What are we looking at tonight or tomorrow night against Marquette? I keep doing that.
Well, let's do tonight because I firmly believe that CBS is just lucky enough to get the Caleb Love game on Saturday. So I think we'll see Carolina and Arizona advance. That feels like a destiny too powerful to resist. And frankly, those are games both teams should win. I don't think we're going to see, UNC Clemson in the regional final, nothing against Clemson, but UNC and Arizona are the two best teams in that region. I think they've played that way. They've both fought off challenges. That just feels like a preordained result that we're going to get that game. CBS usually gets what it wants. I'm not saying there's anything nefarious, but frequently when UNC and Kansas or UNC and Kentucky are in the same bracket, that game ends up happening. And I think we'll see that again with Arizona, which is this year's version of that. As for the Wolfpack, I mean, they have a really tough matchup against Marquette. Marquette's a really good team with a terrific point guard, good shooting guard. It's going to come down to, which is what it's come down to over the last seven games for NC State, is, can DJ Burns be the focus of the offense? Can he make everyone around him better? Which didn't always happen during the regular season. Not all his fault, obviously, but it didn't always happen. And it has happened in the postseason. So can they keep that mojo going against a really good team that plays defense and is impossibly well-coached by Shaka Smart? I mean, there's not a lot of weaknesses to exploit here with Marquette. And it's a team that beat UConn. So, anything is possible.
Anything is possible. I'm there with you. Now, I have some folks wanting me to ask you about this. It was a couple of weeks ago, you and I we raised our voices at each other, debating metrics and, conference strength and superiority
yeah.
and perception of the ACC. Well, 25% of the conference is in the Sweet 16. I think you and I both know that as far as the postseason goes, what the ACC is doing this year, it's kind of par for the course for the ACC over the past half decade. I mean, I guess you could make the argument that maybe the conference isn't quite as good as it was, but it's always the same with the ACC, Luke. They're in it late in the tournament. So what do we say now, a couple of weeks later, about the perception versus reality?
I mean, I wrote this on Monday, I think two things can be true. The number one thing that's true, NC State was fairly selected and seeded. The five teams that the ACC deserved to get in based on the rules we all knew going into the season got in. And it's also true that the ACC, both in terms of seed expectations and sort of analytical predictions, has outperformed in March. And I don't know that you can put your finger on any one reason why for the latter. I mean, I think, is it just a small sample size and the ACC has just, been hitting on 16s and pulling fives? Or is it something about the ACC and the schedule they play and all of that that makes its teams better prepared for March? I think part of it is you have a league in the ACC that has two blue-blooded, dominant powerhouse teams that even though they've had some down years recently are traditionally in that 1-2 seed conversation. So you typically have a couple of horses, right? You're going to have a couple of teams that are expecting to go deep. So it doesn't take that much when you start going further down the roster, whether it's a Clemson or an NC State or a Syracuse, as it has been recently, for other teams to kind of join the party. So I think you can parse this a little bit. But in the end, there's no question. The ACC has outperformed its seeds in March, and that was true when the ACC had three number one seeds, and it's true when the ACC gets five teams in. Why that is, I think, is a little harder to pin down. But, the conversation we had a couple weeks ago, I stand by that. If you go back and look at, and Patrick Stevens had a great thread on Twitter about this the other day, echoing some of the points I made. If you go back to 2018 and 2019, when the ACC was getting 8-9 teams in, there were four or five teams in the ACC going undefeated in the preseason. And you don't see that anymore. Like, you just don't see the ACC winning non-conference games at that rate. That's what comes back to haunt you. And I think, you could say, well, if you look in March, they should get more credit. That's just not how it works. Like, everybody knows the rules going in. You win more games, you'll get more teams in the tournament. Pitt and Wake Forest
both had those opportunities and did not make the most of them, and that's why they are where they are.
Yeah, but I'm not interested in flaring up the argument again, but, I mean, on the football side, the SEC always gets that benefit of the doubt when it comes to the postseason. And getting back to the basketball side, we're talking about non-conference or out-of-conference games. The ACC's now 11-3 against the Big 12 this year. You know, we know what the KenPom and the net rankings look like at the end of the season. And I'm also looking out at the Mountain West, which John Rothstein assured us earlier this year was a better conference than the ACC. And I do, and I'm not afraid to be a bit conspiratorial here, but they signed a new deal with CBS in 2020. All of a sudden, the league that's averaging two bids a year has gotten 4-4-6. And outside of San Diego State, they continue to wet themselves in the postseason every single year. So you can understand how ACC fans are saying, well, wait a minute. You know, it doesn't feel like a whole lot's changed on our side, but it feels like there are some forces at play against us that don't really stack up.
I mean, I can tell you it has changed on the ACC side. The AC, if you look at the collective ACC results as a whole in 2023 and 2024 and compare them to 2018 and 2019, they are not the same thing. They're dramatically different, in fact. And is part of that the ACC going from 16 to 18 to 20 conference games? Maybe. Maybe they're beating up on each other. Maybe they need to go back to 18. I don't have a problem with that. But the reality is when you look at the non-conference performance, it hasn't been as good. And that is going to set the tone for the whole season, whether you like it or not. That is going to set the bar. And, you know, we can argue all we want about the other parts of it. The reality is you look at teams like Wake Forest and Pitt that lost the first game of their holiday tournament. You lose that first game, you play two bad teams, right? Syracuse loses its first game in Maui, ends up playing its third game against Chaminade. You win that first game, then you play good teams. So these opportunities are out there. The ACC is not taking advantage of them the way the ACC used to, and that comes back to bite you. That's not metrics, right? That's not conferences. That's not John Rothstein, the sentient AI, tweeting nonsense around the clock. That is just the reality of the ACC has – now, the ACC did not lose the game in the non-conference portion of the schedule that it's lost the last couple of years. That's definitely an improvement. But you've got to win more games. It's really that simple. It's not about the net. It's not about KenPom. It's not about CBS or John Rothstein or Seth Davis or Mike DeCourcy or conspiracies or, you know, it's not a committee like in the CFP where they just make it up out of whole cloth. Everybody kind of knows the ground rules going in, most of them. The net's still kind of a black box, but whatever. But the reality is, if you actually go back and look at these seasons and look at the ACC's performance, and Patrick did all the work, he brought all the receipts, it's not the same. When it gets back to being the same, the ACC's seeding and selection will look different. And when it does, then the ACC can say, hey, look, now we got nine teams in. Let's go see how we do in March. And maybe the ACC outperforms again, and then you say, hey, you know, there is something going on here. Oh, but maybe it's just a fluke of sample size. I don't, you know, no one knows that part. Why has the ACC done better? There's no answer for that. But you want more teams in. It doesn't really matter how you do in March. You got to do better in November.
All right, a couple quick things we'll let you go. I think you touched on this game a minute ago, but I want to come back to it because I'm getting pretty much two takes on Duke and Houston tomorrow night. It's either, you know, Duke fans saying, hey, we're playing well, we're the more talented team, we're going to win this game, or it's, oh no, this is going to look like the Tennessee game last year. Houston's really physical. Matt Daugherty said Houston's just too physical for Duke yesterday here on the show. Which direction are you going with this one?
Yeah, I don't think either one of those. I mean, I think Duke has gotten over the physical hump a little bit in terms of, you know, James Madison came out kind of bowed up, ready to push Duke around, and Duke waltzed right through them. It helps when Jared McCain hits eight threes, but that wasn't an issue. It wasn't like James Madison, which has a veteran strong team, was pushing Duke around. But I also think Houston's really good. And I think Duke has some confidence right now. I don't think Duke will go out there and get pushed around. But that also doesn't mean that Duke's going to go out there and blow through Houston. You're talking about a veteran defensive juggernaut that takes away everything you want to do. So to me, the key player for Duke, and this is often the case, is Mark Mitchell. Because to me, he's the guy on this team who looks like a Houston player. He's long, he's athletic, he defends, he rebounds, he can get out in transition, he can dunk. Like, if they can get Mark Mitchell going, that's the guy who can unlock Houston's defense. Because Houston's going to get on the shooters, and they're going to find ways to take away Kyle Filipowski. But it's hard to take away Mark Mitchell when he's playing his best, just because he's got that sort of portfolio of skills and athleticism. He's not Duke's biggest star, and he's not Duke's best player. But he's probably their most indispensable player. He watched the Tennessee tape. He obviously didn't play against Tennessee last year. He watched the Tennessee tape before the James Madison game. to get angry about the way they got pushed around. They need that from him against Houston.
All right, last thing. Carolina's still busy in free agency here. Yesterday, a very big addition. Jadeveon Clowney coming home to the Carolinas. We look up, and you know, between him and DJ Wonnum and J.C. Horn and possibly Stephon Gilmore and maybe even Xavier Legette, we're collecting Gamecocks here in the Queen City. But Clowney's the big one yesterday, and I think it's a massive move for them. And he's coming off a career year, matched his career high for sacks, top 20 edge rusher in the NFL. I know he's getting a little bit longer in the tooth, but I thought they needed him, and he could make a big difference. What did you think?
I mean, there's no question they needed him or someone like that, and he's probably the best option on the board right now to fill their biggest need. I mean, that kind of, goes without saying. You know, how much does he have left in the tank? You know, what Jadeveon Clowney do you get when you look at him over the course of his career? Those are all questions that will have to be answered. But I also think, given their situation, given their resources, given what the holes they needed to fill, this is to the extent it's a gamble, it's a gamble worth taking. And you've got a guy coming home who obviously, knows the market, grew up in Rock Hill, all those things. Unbelievable college player. I mean, I remember him against North Carolina in that very rain-delayed game. So, and obviously he went on to have a great career at South Carolina, all those things. But it's a guy they needed, him or someone like him. And the fact that it's a guy coming home, I think adds a little something to it. If whatever he has, I think you'll get the best out of him in Charlotte, because you've got that pride and point close to home.
The Prophet, Luke Dukakis, with us on the Body Works Plus guest hotline. Enjoy Dallas, my friend. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Kyle. Take care.
You tuned in to Instant Replay. When the audio was so good, it has to be heard again. Only on Sports Radio 92.7 WFNZ.
The exclusive home of the Charlotte sports fan.